Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said last week that President Trump had instructed him to continue diplomatic efforts to calm rising tensions with North Korea, saying, quote, "Those diplomatic efforts will continue until the first bomb drops." On CNN, Secretary Tillerson downplayed messages that President Trump had previously posted on Twitter, suggesting the Secretary of State was wasting his time when trying to negotiate with, quote, "Little Rocket Man." That's the derogatory nickname that President Trump has coined for North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un. These Twitter messages appear to undercut Secretary Tillerson's efforts. This is relevant because we're discussing modern diplomacy this hour in the age of social media and new media tools used by governments and politicians around the world. Philip Sieb is a professor of journalism, public diplomacy, and international relations at the University of Southern California. His new book is The Future of Diplomacy. Philip, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Well, as I just mentioned there, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, in constant diplomacy efforts with North Korea, how is modern diplomacy like Twitter messages impacting the Secretary of State's work?
Well, I think mostly the Twitter messages are a distraction. The diplomacy that goes into working with North Korea to get some kind of an agreement on their weapons development has to be really old-fashioned diplomacy, quiet diplomacy, probably secret diplomacy. And the when the president is tweeting or when Kim Jong-un is tweeting, it just throws extra information into the mix, and it's not very helpful.
Well, so you write that for centuries, diplomacy was the domain of an insular elite, and that model is really starting to change. What do you see as the main culprit of this shift?
Well, I'm not sure it's a culprit. I think that if social media are used properly, which doesn't necessarily mean terse pronouncements from world leaders, it opens up the process to the public. The public can see more of what is going on. They can ask questions on social media of the diplomats, and just generally they're going to be more aware of the diplomatic process. A good example was in 2015 when the Iran nuclear agreement was reached. The leaders who reached that, representing the European Union, the United States, and Iran, they announced that they had reached their agreement on Twitter, even before they went out to talk to the news media. And I think that's an important change in diplomacy, because in the past, the news media would be sort of the information brokers. They'd be the gatekeepers. But now the public can be more directly involved in both getting and disseminating information.
President Rouhani's tweets at that time made the case that the agreement was in Iran's best interest. In Washington, President Obama's news conference was at a specific time of day, so that 7 a.m., so that people around the world could have a better chance of catching it. And then there was the State Department and its post to Facebook, Google, Flickr, YouTube. It's as if social media and media tools, that is where all the traffic was in the diplomacy and the rollout of this agreement.
Well, I think that's right. And, of course, the traditional news media were heavily involved as well, but not exclusively involved. And that's the big change. The State Department, when it wanted to reach the public, just as one example, they didn't have to rely on the New York Times or CNN or any international broadcasters. They could go on social media. And, you know, when you've got a Secretary of State such as John Kerry, who had more than 2 million Twitter followers by the end of his tenure, the ability to reach those people, and then, of course, they can retweet the information, that changes the whole way diplomacy has had its relationship with the public in the past.
So you write about this thing called public diplomacy, which has gone from being a nice thing to do to really an essential part of the diplomatic statecraft. What do you mean by public diplomacy then?
Well, public traditional diplomacy is government to government. Public diplomacy is a government reaching out directly to a foreign public to try to influence it in favor of certain policies or just general impressions of a country. One good example of that would be back in the beginning, back in the 1960s, the Peace Corps on the part of the United States, where Peace Corps volunteers were sent directly into foreign communities. But generally what you see with radio broadcasts, satellite television, and now increasingly with social media, this idea that the government can reach directly to foreign publics, that's not a particularly new concept, but with social media, it's much easier to do, and the audience expands tremendously.
We're talking with Philip Seeb. He is a professor of journalism, public diplomacy, and international relations at the University of Southern California. His new book is titled The Future of Diplomacy, and I might add there is a hashtag in front of the word diplomacy on the cover of his book. How have you seen diplomacy change in recent years? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Have you been a diplomat? If so, what do you make of this more open, this more accessible version of diplomacy that we're living in? 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Philip, do you see these changes as welcome to governments around the world? In other words, are other governments also seeing this big shift in how communication is happening in the diplomatic sphere?
Oh, definitely. Just about every major government has some kind of social media strategy to reach foreign publics, and sometimes that's not always with benign intent. I think Russia has become very sophisticated in its use of social media, sometimes to undermine other countries. And really, we're in a transition period still where governments and individuals, for that matter, are still trying to grasp what all this means and how do you sift through all the information, which is not always accurate and sometimes purposely inaccurate. How do you sift through all that and start making decisions about policies and nations and political leaders?
And is there enough horsepower? Are there enough diplomats to sift through all of this information, whether you're sitting in the State Department or the CIA, for that matter?
Right. It's tremendously difficult because what used to be a stream of information has become a flood, and it takes... it takes a lot of personnel to go through that. It takes electronic tools to evaluate the information, to spot certain words and so on. And I think we're still in the process of deciding how to cope with that. And then you have the whole other dimension or additional dimension of terrorist groups and others who use social media so effectively. And that is a particular challenge that governments are still trying to cope with.
So we've come a long way because in your book it says the State Department reportedly suggested a rule that all tweets must undergo a 2-day approval process before being sent. What was the origin of this?
I'm not sure what the origin was, but it met a quick death by laughter because you just can't you can't run Twitter that way. That's the whole point of these social media, is that things happen quickly. And what you have with diplomats, whether they're in the State Department or any other foreign ministry around the world, is there's always been a recognition that fast diplomacy is probably not good diplomacy. But we are being driven now in our media-centric society to do things along the accord with the rules of these new media, which means it's constant and it's fast, and that always doesn't always provide time for reflection, which is usually an asset in diplomacy.
So if diplomats now find themselves responding to a crisis at the moment with little or no time to corroborate the information or to reflect on the consequences of that rapid action, It sounds like that could not be a good consequence. I mean, it sounds like that could be very, concerning there. So what are some examples of where this has worked in preventing a crisis and where this hasn't?
Well, I'm not sure that there are hard examples of where it's worked in preventing a crisis, except for the fact that you can get information out quickly and try to correct erroneous information. So to some extent, it becomes a virtual shouting match that one side puts out one kind of information and the other side puts out another. In a more positive sense, though, when you have a natural disaster, like a hurricane or an earthquake, something like that, then diplomats are using social media to try to identify areas where aid should go, where their own citizens who might have been caught up in the catastrophe happen to be, and try to get them out. It is a very fast means of communication, and really just about everybody who has a cell phone is able to participate in this. Pretty soon, much of the planet, I mean, we already have approximately one cell phone for every person on the planet. Pretty soon, much of the planet is going to have smartphones, and that is going to accelerate the information flow and the information reach even more.
Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has defended his standing within the administration, saying that President Trump's social media pronouncements on major global issues do not undercut his own efforts. But is that really the case as diplomats navigate traditional discussions behind closed doors and the very public diplomacy of living in a social media, knee-jerk reaction world? We're discussing this with Philip Sieb. He is a professor of journalism, public diplomacy, and international relations at the University of Southern California. His new book is The Future of Diplomacy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How have you seen diplomacy change in recent years? Have you been a diplomat? If so, what do you make of this more open, this more accessible version of diplomacy going on? Are diplomatic solutions the answer for some of the world's most pressing conflicts? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And here's something to ponder. Can we crowdsource diplomacy? We'll be back in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said last week that President Trump's social media and his, quote, conducting diplomacy or the lack thereof on Twitter puts everyone at risk. Does Twitter pick at old wounds, or does it open a gateway for conversation about world leaders that wasn't there before 140 characters? We're discussing this new age of diplomacy and the new technology in toolboxes for diplomats. Philip Sieb is with us. He's a professor of journalism, public diplomacy, and international relations at the University of Southern California. His new book is The Future of Diplomacy. In this world of needing immediate feedback, immediate reactions, how does diplomacy adapt and react? Join the conversation, 800-642-1234. Can we crowdsource diplomatic solutions? Is it even possible? 800-642-1234. Philip, let me pose that to you. Can we crowdsource diplomacy? Are we able to influence the outcome of diplomatic efforts by the traffic on social media?
Well, there might be a chance to influence outcomes, because basically diplomatic decisions are political decisions. And if you get strong enough public evidence, strong enough evidence of public involvement in a particular issue that might affect the diplomacy. But in terms of crowdsourcing diplomacy, I guess I'm fundamentally more of an elitist. I think you have to know things to be able to do diplomacy effectively. And a lot of what you get on social media are very fast reactions based on limited knowledge. Remember that on social media, we're generally dealing with small chunks of information. And diplomacy, as with other public matters, tends to be a very complex affair. So crowdsourcing diplomacy, it's kind of a vague concept, but it bothers me a little bit, the concept. I'm not saying that diplomacy can only be conducted by diplomats. Certainly the idea of citizen diplomats and others reaching out to other countries can sometimes be helpful. But it is a profession after all, and I don't think you'd want to crowdsource your doctor's work, and I'm not sure we should crowdsource diplomats' work.
Okay, so how difficult is it for Secretary of State Rex Tillerson to do his job as President Trump sends tweets on major global issues?
Well, I think it's always hard to figure out what President Trump is thinking, but he might be trying to just create enough controversy that somebody such as the Secretary of State can go sort of behind the scenes and get things done, sort of a good cop, bad cop sort of approach. But on the other hand, it might be that President Trump has no clue of what he's doing and therefore is trying to overly simplify the diplomatic process by calling other world leaders, calling them insulting names and that sort of thing in Twitter. I tend to think it's not very helpful. And it's unclear just how much leeway Secretary Tillerson has to conduct foreign policy.
How have you heard traditional diplomats, people who have worked in the State Department for decades, perhaps had posts all over the world, how have they discussed or reacted to this new model of diplomacy?
Well, they tend to be very cautious, which I think is wise. Of course, diplomats who've been involved in the process for many years probably got their start before we had this kind of of media role, and they realize that fast diplomacy is often bad diplomacy, and therefore that social media tend to accelerate things to an uncomfortable level, and so they're even the ones who like the idea of more popular participation in the diplomatic process are unlikely to be very enthusiastic about social media playing an even larger role in diplomacy.
Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was very forward in saying that President Trump's social media is hurting diplomacy and puts everyone at risk. So what are the risks here that she may be referring to? And in general, what are the risks for sending tweets on these major diplomatic missions, if you will?
Well, I think intemperate remarks, it depends on how they're taken, but it changes the level of diplomatic conversation and makes diplomatic conversation more of a shouting match, which is unlikely to be very productive. But I think as long as diplomats have the authority to do their negotiating, to some extent, when they're doing their negotiating, they can tune out some of the background noise you get from social media, while at the same time using those social media to keep the public informed of what is going on. I mean, we have not moved beyond the days of secret diplomacy. And, for example, in 2015, when the United States was negotiating with Cuba about improving relations between the two countries, that was done very quietly. No social media tweets about what was going on until an agreement was reached. And when you get right down to it, that's how diplomacy, for the most part, is going to continue to work. Diplomats talking to diplomats, but now with some added pressure to keep the public better informed of what is going on. And from the diplomat standpoint, the positive thing about social media is they don't have to rely on traditional news organizations to be the gatekeepers. If you want to say something directly to the public, you don't have to worry about it being filtered by a news organization. You can get to the public directly through the social media.
Ah, so there is less likely for things to get convoluted, for innuendo, anything like that, right?
Well, I guess it sounds like you have a fairly dim view of the news media, but I think there's some value in being able to communicate directly. It doesn't shut down the news media. They're still going to have their say and then put their interpretation on events, but it does provide direct access to the public, which diplomats never had before. I think the biggest problem remains speed. In the book, I quote a British diplomat who is talking about the arrival of the telegraph, and he said, "Never do anything today that can be put off until tomorrow." And these new media, whether it's the telegraph or Twitter, they accelerate things, so putting things off till tomorrow can sometimes be difficult.
We're discussing diplomacy in our Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube world with Philip Seeb. His new book is The Future of Diplomacy, and the word diplomacy has a hashtag before it on the cover of his book. He's a professor of public diplomacy at the University of Southern California. You can join into this conversation, 800-642-1234. Are you concerned with how the U.S. is engaging in foreign policy and diplomacy? How has it evolved from past decades, from past negotiations and other stresses in world government? Join in with your question at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Philip, when we think of diplomacy, we tend to think nation-to-nation or state-to-state relations. Is that still the case, or are we now working with a bigger net?
Well, I think public diplomacy has become more important because global publics are easier to reach. And instead of nation to nation, you have nation to public. And now this is nothing new. If you go back, for example, and look during the Cold War or even earlier than that, you had countries such as the United States trying to make their case in a kind of diplomacy to people behind the Iron Curtain. And there are lots of instances of that going far back in time. If you're not an elitist, and if you believe in it, that democracy should extend into diplomacy, all this is to the good. I think there are some in the diplomatic community and in the scholarly community who would approach this with some caution, because the idea is that, again, that diplomacy is complicated, and there are nuances that don't hold up well in the era of social media, and so it's kind of a wash in a way. The public is more involved, which in principle is a good thing, but sometimes the public's expectations and the pressures exerted by the public make the diplomat's jobs more difficult.
Let's break apart here a couple of recent major world events. First, the Iran nuclear deal. And you mentioned earlier, 2015, this nuclear agreement in July, President Obama spearheading, quite the push to put out this agreement. Talk about the role of diplomacy and the impact of new media tools in the Iran nuclear deal.
Well, much of that deal was just traditional diplomacy, making the case in dealing with the Iranians, particularly that they had to cut back on their nuclear development and other concerns. But at the same time, as we could see when the deal was first announced, It was announced via Twitter. And then the political pressure, particularly within the United States, various pressure groups were using social media to make their case either for or against the agreement. You had special interest groups, you had Iranians living in the United States and Iranians abroad pushing in favor of the agreement. So it became more democratic in the sense that, more people were involved in that. But again, it's just a question of degree. If you go back to Woodrow Wilson stumping the United States in favor of the League of Nations, he took that argument to the public. Well, he took it by railroad, and basically it killed him to do that because the stress was so great. Today, he would probably be using social media to try to win support for his concept of the League of Nations.
Let's take a call now, Jim in Crystal Lake, Illinois. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It's a fascinating conversation. My question is, in regards to the fact that President Trump has been doing all this Twittering and kind of deep stabilizing diplomacy, as you've been discussing, I was just wondering if you have any idea whether when diplomats go, let's say our diplomats go to North Korea and other countries, do they have to say to the other people across the table from them, listen, our president, you can't really listen to what he says. He's just spouting off. We're the real negotiators here. We're the people who can start to make some decisions and make some progress, and we'll take back whatever progress we make. Take it back to Washington, and we'll discuss it, and we'll try to move forward. In other words, try to negate some of the responses that President Trump has made. So that was my question.
Yeah, go ahead, Philip.
Well, I don't think American diplomats can say disregard the president of the United States, because even if they personally disagree with him, he still is the president. But on the other hand, again, it's can be sort of a bad cop, good cop situation where they can say, look, you've heard the extreme position as articulated by the president. Now let's get down to work and try to solve this problem. And that's why it's unclear to me, at least, whether President Trump is doing this on purpose or he's just out there doing, you know, things that really don't make much sense. But diplomats, American diplomats, are to some extent bound by what he says. But diplomats also know what their job is. If they have a goal of working, say, with China to try to bring North Korea under control, that involves a lot of subtle trade-offs and matters related to the economy and as well as defense posture and other issues throughout East Asia, for instance, that are unlikely to be covered adequately by social media. So the diplomats are still doing diplomacy.
And Jim, thanks for your call. You mentioned the word subtlety in diplomacy, and it occurs to me social media is just not a subtle place.
Right, and that's one of the big concerns that diplomats have with it, is that there's a lot of nuance in diplomacy, and social media does not allow that. You can't. I don't know if I've ever seen a subtle tweet, and so that's a problem. And of course, the other thing to keep in mind about President Trump's tweets, although he relies on his extensive Twitter following, whenever he tweets, the traditional news media pick up the tweets immediately. And so he really gets a double hit. He reaches his audience directly through social media, and then you get the tweets with commentary usually picked up by whether it's the Washington Post or NPR or whoever. But he reaches a lot of people with those original tweets.
directing the conversation then about what Americans are talking about and reading about and watching.
That's right, and also trying to keep his political base happy, trying to exercise some authority over Congress. It's a complex matter. You know, we think of Twitter as being so simple, but when you look at the ramifications of tweets, it's not so simple anymore. And so you have kind of a collision between the simplistic content of some social media with the complex content of policymaking, particularly in diplomacy.
Let's turn to Syria and look at the failed state in Syria and the negotiations that went on, especially in 2013 to 2015 with President Bashar al-Assad, and where we are at with diplomacy in Syria, and how has social media impacted that, new tools to try to get some type of understanding of how to go forward with Syria, and especially with chemical weapons?
Well, I think social media have been very important in letting the world see what's going on in Syria. For example, there has been a group of journalists, Syrian journalists, and they're not really professional journalists, but they're gathering and disseminating information on social media. It was a group that was called Raqqa is Being Slaughtered Silently. In fact, there's a movie out about these journalists now called The City of Ghosts. And so they have been instrumental in getting information about what's been going on within Syria out to the world public. In terms of diplomacy, well, I'm not sure that we've gotten to the point where there is much diplomacy going on with regard to Syria, because you've got so many people involved now. You've got not just the United States, of course, among the foreign powers, but you've got Russia, you've got Iran, you've got Hezbollah from Lebanon. And from what I can see, whatever diplomacy there is really not getting much traction. It's still a war, and how that failed state, as you put it, of Syria, how that either dissolves or breaks into pieces or gets pulled back together is very uncertain.
Are there any new tools that could be used in trying to negotiate with Syria, in negotiating with the Assad regime?
I don't think so. I think the Assad regime is totally beholden to its patrons, Russia for one, and the Russians, and to some extent probably the Iranians are calling the shots. But I don't know where we go on that. It's very disheartening, and the poor Syrian people, when you look at the rubble that is all that is left of many of their cities like Raqqa and Aleppo, who knows how long it's going to take to make those places just habitable again.
The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, said Thursday that nations who interfere in American elections, quote, is warfare. Her words at a forum at the George W. Bush Institute break with those of President Trump, who has in the past downplayed any Russian interference in the 2016 election. We're discussing diplomacy in this age of Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube with Philip Seeb. His new book is The Future of Diplomacy. He's a professor of public diplomacy at the University of Southern California, where he's also a professor of journalism and international relations. Are you concerned with how the U.S. is engaging in foreign policy and diplomacy? How has it evolved from decades past? Are you a former diplomat? What do you see in the world today as far as diplomacy goes? Join in, 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. rewind back to August, President Trump signed sanctions against Russia. The president has also expelled Russian diplomats from the U.S. Now to this week, the House is set to vote on new sanctions on Iran's ballistic missile program, taking a tough line against Iran without immediately moving to undermine the international nuclear deal. Sounds like more of the traditional forms of diplomacy playing out in the policy forum. We're looking at influences that are forcing the hand of diplomacy this hour and how diplomats work in this environment where governments are all connected by these new media, social media tools. Philip Sieb stays with us. He's our guide. His new book is The Future of Diplomacy. And by the way, the cover of his book has the hashtag before the word diplomacy, quite fitting. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the future of diplomacy? Are diplomatic solutions the answer for some of the world's most pressing conflicts? Join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. So, Philip, you know, as threats continue to escalate with North Korea, there's been talk about a possible diplomatic solution there. As someone who is really looking at diplomacy, what are your thoughts about the reality of that possibility happening?
Well, I think this is a case where multilateral diplomacy is essential, and the key player is China. China has its own interest in keeping North Korea from collapsing, because all those if the regime collapsed, there'd be a tremendous flow of North Korean refugees into China, and they would have to be fed and housed and that sort of thing. And they're also concerned because the more aggressive North Korea becomes, the greater the U.S. military presence in the region, and China wants that region to be theirs. They have their own version of the Monroe Doctrine that wants to keep the United States out of the Pacific, the far Pacific there as much as possible. So I think the key to reaching an agreement lies as much in China's hands as it does in North Korea and the United States. And there might be some other countries in the region that can be helpful as well. But it's very complex, and it shows that diplomacy is not always a one-to-one relationship. There are numerous players involved.
Turning to Russia, when President Trump, he signed sanctions against Russia in August and then expelled Russian diplomats from the U.S., what impact does that have on diplomacy?
Well, obviously, the relationship between the United States and Russia is fairly tense now, in the sense that President Putin and President Trump are often talking at cross purposes, and the U.S. Congress, even more than the president, is unhappy with Russian adventurism in Ukraine, Syria, and elsewhere. Where that goes is anybody's guess, I think, because you've got two major powers that don't seem to be interested, either one of them, in giving up an inch of their position. As with many issues, I think economics is going to be a big factor. If the price of oil drops dramatically again, Russia's economy will be in such bad shape that they might be more willing to talk more reasonably about diplomatic matters.
So when new sanctions are drawn up, whether it's in the case of Russia, whether it's in the case of Iran's ballistic missile program, how much of a sway, how much of a factor is public diplomacy in those sanctions?
Well, with Russia, it's hard to say because the idea of U.S. outreach to the Russian public has limited effect because within Russia, the government controls so much of the media. And that's an important point because I think there's a tendency to have unrealistic expectations. You say, well, if we can put positive messages on Facebook or use Twitter to disseminate information about American policy, the world will listen. Well, the world won't always listen. Whether some countries block internet access or block access to certain social media sites, and also they have their own high volume of content that they provide. That's certainly the case with China and to some extent with Russia as well.
So it's not just what's coming out of the U.S. in terms of social media that is really influencing what is happening perhaps behind closed doors.
Right, right. And it's one of the things that, that the communications revolution, whether it be satellite television or social media, whatever, these media tools serve as great equalizers. Because you get a country like India, for example, which, if it uses these new media tools effectively, basically has the same tools that the United States and Russia and China have. Everybody can play in this game. And so that changes diplomacy, and it changes the whole notion of superpower in terms of affecting global public opinion.
So, you know, with social media changing at the speed of sound, it seems like it's hard to put your finger on the implications of it. How did you wrap yourself around putting this into a book form when, you know, this is evolving so quickly?
Well, it's hard. And I've written books in the past about historical figures, and my advice to people writing books is write about a situation where everybody's already dead, where things aren't going to change overnight. But certainly there could easily be a sequel to the book, The Future of Diplomacy, within a few years, I think, because more and more people are going to be participating. More and more people are going to have internet access. And there's a kind of empowerment that goes with being able to get information. And as you know, one of the things that's happened throughout history is that only a relatively small percentage of the world's population really knows what's going on, has been able to get information. You get there whole continents that have been underserved in terms of getting information. That is rapidly changing. And I think within the next 20 years or so, maybe a shorter time period than that, you're going to have this greater sense of empowerment because people, whether it's in Latin America or Africa or parts of Southeast Asia or Central Asia, are going to know more than they ever have in the past. And that means that the diplomats are going to have new pressures on them because they're not going to be operating in a vacuum. They're going to be operating in a world where the public is much more aware of what they're doing and what the stakes are.
Well, you teach at a University of Southern California that is teaching the future diplomats of the world. You know, what are you teaching them to navigate this world where governments are operating and communicating with each other in very different ways than they did years ago, decades ago?
Well, one of the things is that you cannot get engaged in trading away caution in favor just of speed. I mean, it's much like journalism today, because and that changed some years back when news organizations could go live and covering just about any kind of news. Well, the news organizations found themselves under pressure to report fast rather than to sometimes report accurately. And this similar situation is now taking place with diplomats to act and react quickly rather than with greater certainty. And what I think today's or tomorrow's diplomats have to figure out is how you can put the brakes on a little bit, how you can slow things down. And it's sometimes you have to resist the pressures coming from social media and not get flustered and make unwise decisions. And that's what we're trying to teach, I think, is that our students have a historical perspective on how diplomacy has evolved and understand the wisdom of not trying to let not allowing technology to drive the diplomatic process.
Oh, so diplomats also have to fact check on the fly.
Oh yeah, sure, sure. And you know, you can get a situation that was a so-called movie that was made a few years ago called The Innocence of Muslims that was defamatory toward the Prophet Muhammad. And in the old days, nobody would have even known about it, but little excerpts of it were put up on YouTube, and people died as a result. The U.S. Embassy in Cairo, for example, was stormed because people were so furious with this little snippet of film. The film never was shown in theaters or anything. But see, diplomats have to be able to cope with that. You find this stuff on YouTube, and it can create riots, and that's... Sorry, that's my editorial assistant, my dog, barking there.
No problem. Just for accent.
there he goes. Okay. but it's with that. That's the sort of thing diplomats have to deal with now.
Well, Philip Seeb, going back to the title of your book, The Future of Diplomacy, what do you see in your crystal ball as the future of diplomacy?
Well, I think it still is extremely important because having diplomacy being a vital part of a country's outlook on the world is better than relying too heavily on military force. And that's always been the struggle, is how to balance diplomacy and military pressures. And I'm hopeful that this high speed that we're getting out of changes in media does not drive us toward making rash decisions or deciding that the use of force is an easy way to affect foreign policy. So the future diplomats, the ones that I have in my classes now, for example, their average age, they're graduate students, and then they're in mid to late 20s. But they're still pretty optimistic about the world, and they see social media as a tool. It's not diplomacy itself, but it is a tool to advance diplomacy. And that's a very important issue. I don't like the term digital diplomacy, for example, because I think it confuses the substance of diplomacy with one of the tools, which are the digital media. And so that's... I remain hopeful because there's really not much alternative.
Well, when you think of that phrase, whether you want more diplomats to have meetings or more bullets, there's a fine line in that argument. Will there be more frank conversations? And where will diplomacy head in the future? Is it bullets or conversations?
Well, I think we're always going to have both. Madeleine Albright, former Secretary of State, once said that foreign policy is a matter of kind words and cruise missiles, and it's how you balance those. And I think that's always going to be the case for foreign policy.
Well, Philip, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it.
Philip Seeb is a professor of journalism, public diplomacy, and international relations at the University of Southern California. His new book is The Future of Diplomacy, with a hashtag, by the way, before diplomacy. This hour of the morning show was produced by Chris Molina and Nyasia Ellison. Michelle Johnson is executive producer and provided technical direction. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and thanks for being part of the conversation here on the Ideas Network. Coming up tomorrow at this time, it's another edition of On Your Money with financial planner Kevin McKinley. So have your financial questions ready for tomorrow after 8 with Kevin McKinley. Thanks for listening here on the Ideas Network. Stick around for On Point.